The following program is a presentation of the FlyPod New Media Network. www.theflypod.com.
The Breakfast Lecture Series is sponsored by Mr. Prince Johnson, small business and family solutions representative for Legal Shield, one of the first companies in the United States to offer affordable legal plans for businesses and individual consumers. Our shared mission is to ensure immediate access to quality legal counsel, no matter how trivial or traumatic you think your issue may be. Our network of attorneys are experienced in the areas of law that will impact the growth of your business and the protection of your family. Our network of legal firms currently provide competent, affordable attorneys in 49 states and Canada. We're growing fast with just over 1.5 million members and serving 140,000 businesses. We also provide comprehensive solutions to identity theft, one of the fastest growing categories of crime. With our new mobile apps, you'll discover peace of mind while having a law firm in the palm of your hand for an affordable monthly fee. To learn more, contact your tri-state area Legal Shield representative, Mr. Prince Johnson, at 513-476-5888.
My name's Tom Tennis, and on behalf of the Cincinnati Masonic Center, I'd like to welcome you to this morning's Breakfast Lecture Series featuring Customs and Border Patrol Port Director Richard Gillespie. Richard Gillespie began his law enforcement career with the United States Border Patrol in 1996 in El Paso, Texas. He then worked for several years at the former Immigration and Naturalization Service at the Detroit Port of Entry. Director Gillespie has had positions as a Customs and Border Patrol Supervisor as well as National Coordinator for the Anti-Terrorism Contraband Enforcement Team Training Program. In November 2014, Director Gillespie accepted his current position as Customs and Border Patrol Port Director for the Port of Cincinnati. Please join me in welcoming to the Breakfast Lecture Series Customs and Border Patrol Port Director Richard Gillespie.
Good morning. Well, thank you for having me out here. Somebody asked me, you know, oh, thanks for coming out earlier before we got started here today. And I said, well, no problem. I like to brag on my guys and tell everybody what we do. And one of the reasons, and this is by no means, this is very, very common. Everybody says Customs and Border Patrol. Happens all the time because they mix it up with U.S. Border Patrol, but it's Customs and Border Protection. You know, in the scheme of things, it's not important, but what I'm trying to get at is that as an agency, we are very, very young. Everybody knows who the FBI is. Everybody knows who the CIA is. Secret Service, very common. Comes, you know, everybody knows who that is. But with CBP, we're a younger agency. Let me go through a little bit and explain who we are and why we are doing what we're doing. U.S. Customs and Border Protection, there's about 60,000 employees, and we're made up of several former agencies. Our primary focus, obviously, is anti-terrorism, but we still have a lot of our legacy missions that we enforce. We enforce immigration laws, prior U.S. customs laws, agriculture, all of that, okay? But we're broken down into several components, and I'll kind of try to give a little bit of an overview of what we do on each component, and I've had the honor of being able to work in all of those areas. We're the first full-service border entity, and I know that that may sound unusual, but from a national or a global perspective, most countries still utilize a system similar to what we used to have prior to 9/11. We work very closely with different countries, anywhere from South Korea, Turkey, Israel, Germany, Mexico, trying to help them strengthen and bolster their border security programs. The men and women of CBP are responsible for enforcing hundreds of laws and regulations. On a typical day, CBP welcomes nearly 1 million visitors. And I'm going to go through some stats at the end and kind of talk about why it's impressive and why it's a little bit of a daunting task. Like you can see up on the screen here, they talk about 1 million visitors on a typical day, 67,000 cargo containers. We arrest more than 1,100 individuals and seize nearly 6 tons of drugs every single day. The Department of Homeland Security was created in March of 2003, and it really arose from the ashes of September 11th. Okay, I'm sure everybody in here is more than familiar with what transpired that day, but there was a wake-up call that went along with that. You know, immediately following 9/11, you know, there were a lot of comments about, well, immigration did this and immigration didn't do that. And there was some blaming, right? The nation was hurt and there was some pain there and we were frustration. You know, but the reality is that our system wasn't really designed at that time to really handle, the focus wasn't there for terrorism, right? That was something that occurred over there. Didn't occur here in the United States, right? So our process really, you know, it worked. It worked as it was meant to work, but it didn't work well enough. And that was a point that was made loud and clear. The information sharing component alone was a tragic and epic failure on our part. We just weren't communicating. We didn't need to up until that point. That's not rocket science. I mean, that's stuff you can read about in the 9/11 report and so on. Okay, but they talk about, well, you know, where did they get these visas that allowed them to enter the United States? Well, they went through the process that, you know, to a large extent we still utilize today. They went to the Department of State, they applied for their visa, you know, they traveled to the United States, they presented their paperwork was correct and proper, an inspection was completed, and they were allowed to enter the United States. Who knows, is anybody familiar with who Al-Qahtani was? He was kind of an unknown. He was the one individual that we intercepted. Out of all the terrorists that were responsible for the 9/11 attack, Al-Qahtani was the only one that we caught. Okay, again, terrorism in the United States was not something that generally occurred. Okay, when he made entry into Orlando, okay, and this is not secret squirrel stuff. I mean, you can read about this in a host of different locations. But when he made entry into Orlando, and this just is to show the difficulty of the job that we face. When he made entry into Orlando, he went up to the officer, and I'm sure all of you have traveled, probably, or most of you have traveled internationally. You go up and you hand your passport and your documents to the inspecting officer, and they take a look at it. They said to the individual, "Where are you going today?" And he said, "Well, I'm going to Disney World." Pretty normal thing to have happen in Orlando, right? He said, "Well, okay, how long are you going to be here?" "For a week." Seems pretty reasonable still, right? Who here has gone to Disney World? Please, show of hands. It's insane expensive, right? I had to sell one of my kidneys to take my kids to Disney World. So he said, "Okay." He goes, "How much money are you traveling with?" He goes, "Oh, I have $2,000. Okay, $2,000 spending cash for a week in Orlando. That's not unreasonable, you know. What hotel are you staying at?" "I don't know. I haven't found one yet." Anybody that's tried to go to Disney knows you better darn well have your hotel in check before you get there. So the officer was like, "Something's not right here," and he sent him in. Now, we all know that one plane or two planes hit the towers, one plane hit the Pentagon, and the other one went down in a field, right? Okay, there is speculation that Al-Qahtani was destined for that other plane. And who's to say what kind of a difference that single incident made? Where would that plane maybe have arrived? Maybe it would have reached its destination. Now, ultimately, I'm sorry, we failed. We did not stop the threat. But the threat was new. We didn't know what the threat was. But we caught that individual. And we caught that individual because of questioning. Now, everybody that's traveled internationally, I'm sure you've experienced some level of frustration coming in, waiting in line to get back in, right? Everybody's thoughts are the same. I've heard this 100,000 million times. Okay, I'm not even exaggerating. That's an exact number. People come in and they say, "Oh, I'm a U.S. citizen. I've been waiting in line for an hour." Yep, you are a U.S. citizen. You've been waiting in line for an hour. And I can appreciate the frustration because everybody's in a hurry these days, right? We all have to get where we're going and get there as quickly as we humanly possibly can. But the job that these officers have is to determine what your intent is. Wow, what a daunting task. I have a lot of friends who work in law enforcement. When a police officer generally pulls someone over it or interacts with somebody, it's because something has already occurred, something factual, a definitive event has taken place, right? My officers have to deal with intent. What do I think this person's intent is for entering the United States? and they have to do it like that. Anybody drive across the southwest border, come into the United States from Mexico before? The line is painfully long, and you come up, and the officers have like a quarter of a second to make a decision. Make a decision that could affect the outcome of something serious. So I always ask people to please be patient and understand the difficulty of their job. Luckily, we were at least successful enough to stop Al-Qahtani, but we did not stop Mohammed Atta and the other individuals who were responsible for 9/11. So in March of 2003, essentially the Department of Homeland Security was created. Okay, it you know, if we want to be really dramatic, it rose from the ashes of 9/11 and it came to be what it is today. But, you know, we're thinking 2003 or 2017, we are a young agency. Okay, so we're still going through growing pains. Let's talk a little bit about what and who we are as far as the uniform components of CBP. The three main ones, and this is the one that I belong to, is the Office of Field Operations. It's the largest component in CBP, and it's responsible for border security to include anti-terrorism, immigration, anti-smuggling, trade compliance, agriculture protection. We have to enforce all these laws while simultaneously ensuring and facilitating lawful trade, lawful travel. And so we're responsible for all these ports of entry, and it's critical to our nation's economy. Facilitating lawful trade and travel, that's a daunting task. Meanwhile, we have to enforce a host of laws from other agencies. OFO is headed by an assistant commissioner who is responsible for overseeing the operations of 20 field offices, 328 ports of entry, and 70 locations in over 40 countries internationally, and with a staff of more than 28,000 employees and an operating budget of over $3.2 billion. Okay, we are the world's largest law enforcement agency. There was something that I just saw on the news recently. They were talking about, Department of Homeland Security is trying to create its own army. They ordered, you know, some insane amount of ammunition. They're like, look, this is proof. They're trying to create this army. And it's like, no, that's just what we need to practice our academies and our qualifications. Really, there's no sinister malintent there. So what OFO does is they basically handle all those ports of entry, the airports, the seaports, the land border crossings. You know, they're responsible for inspecting things as they enter the United States. I always tell my guys, you know, your job is to focus on what's in front of you, and there are other entities that focus on what's behind you. It is exponentially easier for us to stop the threat that's in front of us than it is to find the threat that's behind us, right? How many times do we have to be right when we're making a determination about who's coming into the United States? All the time, 100% of the time. How many times do the bad guys have to get it right? Just once. I explained to my guys when I was at the academy, and even today, I'm like, if you don't know what these people are coming to do, no one does. You must find out. So if anything I can leave you with as far as talking about Office of Field Operations is to please be patient when you're traveling internationally and understand why we do what we do. The U.S. Border Patrol, this is where I started my career. The United States Border Patrol is headed by a chief Border Patrol agent. It's headquarters of the primary federal law enforcement organization responsible for preventing the entry of terrorists and terrorist weapons from entering the United States between the official U.S. Customs and Border Protection ports of entry. These are the guys that are out there, out in the desert lands, in between those ports of entry. And that's where I started my career, in El Paso. And I was talking with an individual before we started today who had also worked there. And we were reminiscing a little bit about what it was like. You know, he was talking a little bit about what it was like when he started, and I was talking a little bit about what it was like when I started. There was definitely a element of esprit de corps with the U.S. Border Patrol. We went through that academy, and we were reminded on a daily basis that you're going to be alone, and you're going to be out there, and there's going to be a lot more of them than there are you. I worked in El Paso, Texas, and we were responsible for the area from, you know, basically San Ysidro not San Ysidro, Isleta, and all the way through into the other part of Texas, the other side of El Paso. So we spent a lot of time trudging around out in the mountains, looking for smugglers, looking for illegal aliens. Now, I say this all the time. I said it at the academy, and I've said it throughout my entire career. You probably wouldn't stop me. If I was born in Mexico and wanted to make it into the United States, I would keep trying. Because I saw what existed out there. I remind people that although we have a job to do, and our job is imperative to make sure that we are sympathetic to their plight, I would want to be here. I wouldn't want to work there. I used to sit in El Paso and look out across the border, across the Rio Grande, and there was an area called Shantytown, which was basically a small neighborhood or city portion of Juarez that was constructed out of pallets and garbage and doors and abandoned garbage. And I would watch these people who lived in utter squalor. It was sad. It was tragic. And they would be there with their kids, and they would be doing the best they can. Now, that doesn't diminish or decrease the need for us to do our job, but it put it into a little bit of perspective. On the cold nights when the desert and the winds were blowing hard and it was cold, you know, even though here we are out in West Texas, it still got pretty darn cold at night sometimes, they would light these little fires in these homes. And sometimes the homes would catch on fire. And I would see them standing out there in the cold, everything they owned burned to the ground, and there's nobody there to help them. So please be sympathetic of the plight, understand it, but again, the need for us to be there is still very relevant. With the Border Patrol, their mission has remained largely the same. When 9/11 happened and CBP, or Homeland Security, was created, they remained largely untouched. Their job and their mission focus is still very, very specific. Of course, you know, they're always looking for that anti-terrorism element. Do you think, do terrorists cross the southwest border or try to? Anything you can think of, they're thinking of too, right? So, you know, I implore you to, if you have the opportunity, there are a lot of great books out there. But the 9/11 Commission really is a hard read, but it's a good one. So that's just my little ticket that there. The U.S. Border Patrol, they'll utilize horseback patrol, foot patrol, vehicle patrol, ATV patrol, motorcycle patrol, and bike patrol. Keeping in mind, sometimes depending on where you're stationed and what your assignment is for the day, you might be 50 miles from the next agent, which makes it rough when you encounter a group of people. You know, there were times where, unfortunately, I have to admit, the ones I caught were the slowest ones. I'm not being funny. I mean, I'm being serious. You know, if there's just me and there's 10 of them, you know, you're catching the slowest ones, right? You can only stop as many as you can. A lot of the times we had to rely on, you know, officer presence and getting their attention and to maintain control of the situation, and it got difficult at times. I remember feeling particularly outnumbered one time. There were a lot of old train tunnels that run across the border, and over the years, the border, the physical border, has shifted a little bit, right? And so there was a train tunnel that ran through a small segment of a mountain pass in El Paso, and I was chasing a crew through this tunnel, and you had to crouch and run through it. And I remember there were about three or four of them, and I saw one or two of them go to each side of the tunnel on the outside, and they stopped. And I could tell they were standing there waiting for me to come out, and there wasn't much I could do. You know, that's the type of threat that these agents see on a daily basis. That's regular, reoccurring stuff. And trying to handle that situation, maintain control of it, and go home at the end of the night is always our primary focus, right? So, again, just bear in mind kind of what these agents deal with on a regular, reoccurring basis. Air and Marine Operations. The mission of Air and Marine Operations is to protect the American people and nation's critical infrastructure through the coordinated use of integrated air and marine forces to detect, interdict, and prevent acts of terrorism and the unlawful movement of people, illegal drugs, and other contraband toward or across the borders of the United States. This sounds very Miami Vice type stuff. It's a pretty rough job, actually. It is exciting and it is fun, and I have had the opportunity to ride with them on a couple operations. One that comes to mind was off the coast of Florida, and I want to say it was in February or March. Air and Marine, their air supply or air support unit, spotted a go-fast boat coming in out of the Caribbean. Our job was to intercept them and stop the boat to determine what was going on. It led to about a 50-mile boat chase in the middle of the night, which resulted in us capturing a boat full of smugglers and about 24 Cubans that were coming in. It was exciting, but I don't know that I would want to be crashing into waves, you know, night after night after night out on the high seas. But it was a pretty exciting chase. And to be able to take the smugglers down and seize their boat, it was a pretty good operation. But, you know, the Air and Marine Division really has a tough job. You know, they're understaffed. Not too long ago, anybody see the news report about the plane that landed in, I guess that would be Eastern Ohio, a couple weeks ago, loaded with the cocaine? I bet you that plane crew was hoping they would have made it into Canada, because I want to say it was about 150 pounds of cocaine, but they had to put down at the university over engine troubles, and Air Marine was right there. The three-pronged mission. CBP as a whole tries to use a very layered approach in order to ensure that we catch everything. You know, we secure America's borders, you know, expediting the movement of people. Bearing in mind with America's borders, there's essentially 7,000 miles of border between the U.S. and its Canadian-Mexican neighbors. That is a lot of real estate to patrol. Obviously, our largest focus is on the southwest border, but that doesn't eliminate or indicate or mean that there are no issues on the northern border, right? We have to rely on the use of you know, air patrol, boat patrol, in order to, you know, help our ground forces to make sure that we're seeing what we're seeing. Securing and expediting the movement of people. CBP officers inspected 340 million travelers and more than 105 million cars, trucks, buses, trains, vessels, and aircraft. Okay, and that was in FY11. So it keeps growing. It keeps growing. Securing and expediting the movement of goods. One out of every four jobs in the U.S. depends on international trade. I would even garner that could be a touch higher now. Last year alone, CBP collected $37.2 billion in duties, taxes, and fees. Okay, I'm sure everybody who's familiar with the, you know, the idea of customs understands that the collection of revenue was its primary focus a long time ago. Just to kind of give you an idea, here's our map. This is our kind of shows you national operations within the United States, within the continental United States. I'll run into people. I'll be out driving my vehicle around. I'll stop and get gas or something like that. And somebody will be like, well, you're a long way from the border. But we also deal with the functional equivalent of the border. And that's what we utilize at the airports and some of those ports of entry inside the continental United States in the interior. You can obviously see how much we have going on down here along our southwest border, you know, and the northern. Needless to say, the dynamics along the southwest border have changed quite a bit over the last 6 months or so. But you know, we have been having to send a lot of our officers and resources down there. In the last part of the year here, I've had three or more of my officers TDY down to the southwest border to help process the influx of illegal aliens making entry who have been intercepted. It's a daunting task. It really is. CBP, you know, like I said, we try to do that layered approach. We have implemented a lot of different trade and travel programs. You know, jokingly, somebody told me in my office today or yesterday before I left work, they're like, make sure you let them know that, yes, it is that long of a wait for the global entry program, because I don't know about you, but we have a huge backlog of global entry. It's a great program. The response has been overwhelming. And we are trying to work on that. Anybody who is in the queue for a global entry card, I'll give you the name of somebody else you can call and complain about to after. But, you know, we try to use these programs in order to facilitate trade. We want to target, we want to do trend analysis, and we want to take those low-risk travelers and clear them and vet them as much as we can in the front end so that we have less to do with them, when they're making entry. And we can focus our efforts and energy where we need them. Our international footprint. Again, we have many, many locations overseas. This has grown, I don't even know what percentage it's increased over the last 10 or 15 years. And it's smart, and this is why. It's a more economical and safer way of doing business. We have the Container Security Initiative. We have the Immigration and Immigration Advisory Program. We have the CBP attaché positions, and we have the pre-clearance positions. Has anybody traveled to Aruba, Bermuda, Bahamas? Okay. I see a few hands go up. You've experienced that CBP inspection process overseas in the foreign country. I was lucky enough to, I did a hardship duty in Aruba for 2 years, and I really suffered through that. So any sympathy that you want to give me after, I'll take that. I really suffered through that, living about a quarter mile from the Caribbean Ocean. But, you know, it was a great experience. And really what we're trying to do is we're trying to push those borders out. We want to stop the threat. We want to stop the issue before it even lands in the United States. It's kind of a win-win for the host country and for us because it helps to increase and facilitate trade and travel for them at their locations. It makes things a little easier for them. And it keeps that threat over there. Right? That's where we want it. We want it over there. We do not want it behind us. We want it in front of us at all times. You know, they are looking to increase and expand the pre-clearance position. It allows us to, you know, collaborate and increase, I think, our effectiveness to a large extent by working with the host countries and having that communication, that information sharing with them on the ground there. And really, that was one of the big things that came from the 9/11 report, is that we have to increase that communication sharing. We have to increase that collaborative effort. Securing and facilitating trade and travel, that risk segmentation, revenue collection, and partnerships. International trade is really truly the lifeblood of our economy. What we bring in, what we send out, I don't think there's anything there that's a surprise to anyone. I know that there are some people here that work in the cargo industry. And we work very closely with them in order to improve that. And again, it's about that information sharing, it's about that collaborative effort, and it's about that partnership. I'm pretty certain that nobody in here wants to see anything, you know, any type of 9/11 attack or any other type of attack or anything that would hurt the United States. And so it's through those types of efforts and building those relationships that we can help achieve that and minimize that risk. Technology has become a big thing over the last 15 years, really increased focus on that as far as scanning inbound containers. Everything, 100% of cargo entering the United States is cleared and screened for radiation. You know, again, we're trying to target, look for that high-risk shipment and move that low-risk freight down the road as quickly as we can. All right, here are some statistics that we'll go through, and this is a day in the life of CBP. And I'll probably not go through and read each bullet. I don't want to bore you to death, but I will hit on some of the highlights. Okay, on a single day, we clear nearly 1 million passengers and pedestrians. Think about that on a per person, per inspection level at the speed in which that needs to move. Nearly 270,000 incoming privately owned vehicles at the ports of entry. That is immense. And $6.3 billion worth of imported goods every single day. Here's the stuff I like because I'm a very enforcement-minded person. Okay, we have every day 1,140 apprehensions between the U.S. ports of entry. That's the U.S. Border Patrol. 750 refusals of inadmissible persons at U.S. ports of entry. That's what we do at like CVG. When we stop somebody coming inbound, and we deal with that intent that we talked about. Now, sometimes there are clear indicators of either criminal activity or administrative violations. You know, they're coming to work and live illegally. Sometimes it's a lot more difficult to get to the bottom of it. But that's 752 every single day. And 22 arrests for wanted criminals at U.S. ports of entry every single day. 7,910 pounds of drugs. Nearly $290,000 in undeclared or illicit currency, and $3.8 million in IPR violations. I want to just talk about the undeclared currency and the drugs a little bit. I want to say in Cincinnati alone last year, we intercepted close to 8 tons of hard narcotics. We're talking heroin, cocaine, methamphetamine, and most importantly and most prevalent now is the fentanyl issue. just in recent month or so, I want to say we intercepted, what was it about, is it 80 pounds? 36 pounds of fentanyl alone. That doesn't include the other synthetic chemicals that we intercepted, like the date rape drugs, things of that nature. We did a little bit of an analysis on that, and it ended up being 24 million lethal doses of fentanyl. Lethal doses. Because a lethal amount is about a pinhead amount, depending on the purity. Undeclared currency. Has anybody read anything on the first World Trade Center bombing? Okay. That was funded through the selling of IPR, intellectual property rights, through the selling of basically knockoff goods, T-shirts. That was funded largely through that and through currency smuggling into the United States. Now, just for everyone's record, there is no limit to the amount of currency that somebody can take in or out of the United States. It's completely legal. You can move as much as you want in and out, but you have to declare it, and that's why. Okay, we need to be able to track where it's going and where it's coming in from. There's no taxation purposes, so if anybody's traveling overseas and they want to buy a house somewhere in the Caribbean, that is okay. Just let us know, please. Ms. Bishop here is an agricultural specialist that she works for me, and she handles a lot of the agricultural inspections, trying to keep that agricultural threat out of the United States and the impact that that can have to the economy and our food sources. In a typical day, 404 pests and 4,638 materials for quarantine are intercepted. And the impact to our economy could be catastrophic if it wasn't for the work that these ag specialists do. And in any individual day, there's been about 1,500 canine teams or horse patrols that are put out, hundreds of hours of enforcement missions across the United States in and around the coastline, and float hours with the Marine Division. This is kind of a breakdown of what our makeup looks like. We have roughly 60,000 employees, nearly 23,000 CBP officers. Fortunately, we have, I think, a insufficient amount of agriculture specialists and roughly 20,000 Border Patrol agents. Thank you very much, everyone.